this week on The Inside Flap.
Once she thought of a murder for me that involved a stairlift, you know, that had to be passed is a stairlift. And I did use it in the book, and I got a review, a good review, and I think it was in the Financial Times, actually, and it said, Ellie Griffiths has thought of the nastiest use of a stairlift I've ever seen. And my Aunt Marge was so proud that she had that frame.
Andrew, can you guess? She put the kibosh on the idea of using cupcakes. What do you think she said that she might offer him some kind of goods in return so that he would not be suspicious and would come running out of the house?
Some extra weed?
Whoa! Hey! Okay, Andrew Dowd, first guest.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast, and we thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably on the couch to my left, that's Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Who's busily fiddling with my headphones volume.
Can you turn
control? We're all a little. That's mine. You know, you just turned my sound off.
I'm there, number there one, Andrew, as I should be.
Laura's always number one.
Can you turn me up a little bit?
Turn her up a little bit as we welcome you to
The Inside Flap,
a book podcast, and maybe it might be our last time indoors of the season. We might be back out in the snack shack next week, depending on the weather. Springtime in the Rockies, as we were just talking about before we got on the air, is always a little bit tricky.
10-day forecast looks good.
Okay.
For next Tuesday.
Robert Justice will be pleased to know that Angela will be back on the floral settee.
Well, we'll see.
Who else mentioned the floral settee?
Next week is the end of April. Well, that's right. Yeah.
So I will be here next week, but I'm flying out to Maryland for 2 weeks towards the end of next week.
Will we get to talk to you from the Airbnb?
No. Well, yeah, actually, yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You say what? No.
Well, I was thinking bed and breakfast.
Oh,
but
I
actually stay at the Airbnb.
Well, you know, ironically, I was thinking bed and breakfast, but I said Airbnb.
Yeah, and it was just the opposite for me.
Sorry.
We do have a great show for you today. We are joined once again by one of our favorite guests. It's always a pleasure to talk to Ellie Griffiths, author. You know Ellie Griffiths. She's author of the Ruth Galloway mysteries, among others. She has a new book out now called The Last Word. I really loved, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that in a bit, along with our conversation with Ellie, which, as usual, was a lot of fun. Laura and I chatted with her. But first, Andrew, have we told you about this senior assassin? By the way, it's not... There's not a bunch of
old assassins,
octogenarians running around with machine guns. Senior assassin. Do you know what a senior assassin is?
I do not.
Okay. You will find out in 3 years when Dashiell is a senior in high school. Senior assassin is a game played by seniors in high school, as Sylvia is one right now, in which they pretty much run around with run around with water pistols. And their mission is to try to get other people in the game out.
You get targets.
Right. You get targets. You have to hit your target. Now, the safety...
You have to film your target
is
getting hit.
If your target is wearing goggles, in Sylvia's school's case, at East it was little arm floaties.
Water wings.
If they're wearing goggles, they can't be got. So you can't get them. But you try to get them when they're out in public. You can't get them at their work. You can't do it at school. You can't do it inside their house, but you try to get them out. And Laura, you actually went out with Sylvia and got, because you can see everybody has to open up full access to Life 360 on their phones, so you can see where everybody is. Mm-hmm. And Laura, when did you help Sylvia get her first target?
A few weekends ago, we went up to a restaurant and had stalked this kid.
Right.
I'm not going to say his name. We had stalked this kid.
Isolate that.
I had already known what
stalked this kid.
I knew the kid. Like, I knew what he looked like. So okay. That was a help.
Right.
And supposedly he was in this restaurant up at River Point. So I said, Sylvia, I'm going to go in first. I'm just going to casually look around the restaurant. I'm going to back out and I'm going to tell you where he's sitting. So I walk in. He's fortunately for me, I'm a middle-aged woman. No one pays attention to middle-aged women.
Right.
I'm casually looking around for a table. I spot him almost immediately because he's right near the door with like two aunties or like a mom and an auntie, two middle-aged also women with him, flanking him. And I thought, okay. So she's waiting outside. She's got a giant water bazooka, basically, clutched in her hands.
Sylvia does, yes.
Yep. So she goes in before me. She holds it down by her side like any good assassin would, just casual with bazooka.
Yep.
And I film it and we get him.
Right.
And he was a great sport. He smiled and laughed and his mom smiled and laughed as well.
Right. So that was her first target.
It's a little adrenaline rush, Andrew. Yeah.
As I found out when last weekend they had, it was Purge Week. So you didn't have a specific target. You could get anybody who was still left in the game. And there was, I think there was like 12 people
goggles
left in the game.
Goggles won't save you.
And goggles, that's right, goggles won't save you. So we pull up the Life 3. Sylvia's like, I need to get somebody out, otherwise I'm going to be out. We need to get somebody, you know, in the next couple of days. So it was Saturday, and I said, all right, well, pull up your Life 360 and let's see. And she pulls it up, and you can see, and she's like, all right, this kid's in his house, this kid's at work. And you can, listen, this app even tells you, like, how long they've been there. So it's like this kid was at a restaurant, but he'd been there for 5 hours. So you knew that was
he's working. Yeah.
Can't go there. So we see everybody's either working or inside their house.
It was
so,
a snowy night.
I said, so I don't know what we're going to do. She says, well, I know this kid in this house down here. Maybe we can drive down there and we can figure out some way to lure him out of the house and I can get him with the water gun.
Call him Matthew.
Yeah, we'll call him Matthew. I say, great, perfect. So we hop in the truck and as we're driving down there, we're trying to fit. She's like, what should I say? She knows she can text the kid. What can I say to get him out of the house? I said, aha, I got it. And inspiration struck me. I said, tell him you were at your cousin's birthday party, and then I got even more inspiration struck. Tell me you were at your little cousin's birthday party right around the corner, and you had some extra cupcakes that were left over from the party.
Yeah. Like, this is an 8-year-old boy.
Listen. Yeah.
This is like an 18-year-old
boy. I thought this was
boy.
The greatest idea in the history of ideas, in the history of Senior Assassin. And you got extra, because look, I love a good cupcake.
Free snacks. Sounds plausible to me.
I'm thinking what would get me out of the house. Yeah. And what's plausible, thank you. Operative word there is plausible to get this kid who knows the game out of the house so he doesn't think it's some kind of setup. So I said, actually, you got cupcakes and we can pull up and he'll come out to grab his cupcake and I can film you getting him with the water gun. She says, okay, that sounds all right. And there's some silence for the next 5 minutes.
She's pondering.
And she comes up with what I determined to be a much, much better idea. Andrew, can you guess? She put the kibosh on the idea of using cupcakes. What do you think she said that she might offer him some kind of goods?
Yeah.
In return, so that he would not be suspicious and would come running out of the house.
Some extra weed?
Whoa!
Hey!
Andrew Dowd, first guest.
Andrew Dowd!
Yes, give himself a drink. And now, in fact, let's...
Check out the big brain on...
Andrew!
There you go, yes.
I did not think you would get that, Andrew. No.
Andrew's right on top of that. She told him she had some weed. And now at this point it's cold and it's raining. It's a cold drizzle that's coming down and it's also dark. So it's not dark, but it's getting dark. It's like twilight. So I said, aha, Sylvia, you're a genius. Text him that. So she sends out a text immediately and it's like his fingers must have burnt up by how fast. sure. Come on over. I'm here. Here's my address. Boom, 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 boom. Like he doesn't suspect, clearly he does not suspect at all that she's going to get him.
Now, I will say I've learned, I've worked with people in different business partnerships.
Yeah.
And I found that when the greed, like when the greed light gets turned on, right? And so I work at these business partners, they're logical, they scrutinize things, but then sometimes they'll see big money and it turns their brain
off. It's like spotlights to their eyes.
So if you can figure out like what that trigger is.
What activates it.
Yeah. Well, she figured it out with this kid, Matthew, that it was weed. So he said, yep, come on over. So we pull around. So now...
Well, she knows Matthew.
Right. Also. So she knew what would get him. So we are now around the corner. I get out of the truck. I say, listen, I'm going to pretend to be walking down the street. You... which is ridiculous because it's raining and it's almost dark and it's like this suburban neighborhood. There's not a soul out in sight. I said, you drive out, drive around the corner in my truck and, you know, you call him and he'll come out. So I start walking around the corner and immediately two houses down, I see him. He's already outside of his house standing on the sidewalk. Well, the funny thing is he had actually texted back when she told him she had free weed. He said, well, let me check to make sure. Oh, this was weird. Let me check to make sure my grandmother's not sitting on the porch, which is kind of strange.
Well,
but it turned out grandma was not sitting on the porch, so he was out there, and I was curious what he would tell his parents and grandma that would get him out of the house. But whatever. So I'm walking down there. I immediately put my phone to my ear, pretend like I'm having a conversation. I'm saying something like, yeah, I was supposed to meet her right here. I don't see where she is. Some ridiculous inane thing. I walk right past the kid, literally right past the kid. Find out later, he's actually been to our house.
Yeah.
He actually told Sylvia later, I thought I recognized your dad.
Oh, he recognized you.
Well, he recognized me.
He kind of sort of recognized.
Right.
That's the way it is.
Kind of, sort of, but he was so fixated on the weed. He's not. So I walked past him.
That's really, in retrospect, he's like, oh, yeah.
Then I hear the truck pull up. So I turn around. I see the kid go around the truck. Sylvia gets out of the driver's side. He has to walk around the truck to meet with her. I turn around, pick up my phone, film the video, but unfortunately, because I'm filming, he was walking up to Sylvia, and I'm behind him. I'm filming his back. So she shoots him. He is despondent. He clearly knows, first of all, he's been got. He's out of the game.
And
second of all,
there's no weed.
More importantly,
there's no weed.
She starts laughing. I start laughing. He turns around. He sees me. And he's like shaking his head. He can't even like enjoy the moment. He starts walking despondently back.
Did you get that on video?
Back to the house. No. Well, here's the thing. I get back in the truck. We start driving away. And so he's like, let's see the video. So I pull up the video. She's looking at it. She goes, we have a problem. And I said, what's the problem? She says, you didn't get the video. I mean, I said, what are you talking about? I pull over, I look at it, and yes, I completely blocked her shooting him with the water gun. All you can see is his back. So now she has to actually call him and say, hey, would you mind coming back out? Because in this game, you know, you have to upload a video as proof onto Instagram that you got the kill. So she has to like call him. He's like, yeah, I'll come back out. So we turn around, we go back.
It's a funny video of him just standing in his driveway.
He comes out in his front yard. Yeah, he just stands there. Sylvie's holding the water gun. She turns to me. She's like, are you rolling? I said, yep, go ahead. And then literally just stands there and she squirts it. And it hits him.
He's got his pajamas on too.
Yeah, no reaction at all. And we get the shot. So, but it was very exciting. And I'm telling you, my blood got pumping. The adrenaline was flowing. It was very, very exciting.
When I went into that restaurant with her to get the other kid, I felt charged up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would have been even more exciting. Because
you know what happened to her today? She came home in between school and work.
Uh-huh.
And I heard her out front. I was sitting doing work on the sofa. And I could hear her talking to somebody out front. And then laughter. And then she walked in. And she was full of adrenaline because now she knows who has her as a target. They had followed her. This kid had followed her. And she knew that a car was tailing her.
Oh, boy.
So she was aware.
Very safe game.
She saw that this car is tailing her. And so she checked her life's 360 after she parked. And she sees that it's this kid.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, I bet he has. So she put her goggles on and stepped out. and the boys, it was two boys in a car. They slowly rolled by and she just goes, not today. And they were like, oh man.
Not today.
Yeah, they thought they had her.
Yep. So. She doesn't leave the house without those goggles anymore. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got to stay safe.
That'll be fun for you and Dashiell.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
It's voluntary, so you don't have to. He doesn't have to.
And you basically pitch in, like, I don't know, what was it, $50 entrance?
Oh, no.
Entrance fee?
Like five.
Oh.
Like there's a ton of people that do it.
Right. So, and then the winner takes the pot. How it goes. Anyway, Laura, how has your week been?
Oh, it's been great.
Actually, I should rephrase that. Oh. The winner does not take the pot. Okay. The winner takes.
You need to clarify. You do need to clarify.
Takes the money.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, no. So Sylvia, braggy parent, got a scholarship from a Littleton Public School Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the four high schools in Littleton Public School District award it every year to one student from the high school. So she got the Spirit Award for Littleton High School. So we went to a fundraising event and also
big to do.
And the big highlight of it was the Spirit Scholarship that they talk about each kid. They have a slideshow. They shake the hand of the superintendent. They do all this stuff. And it, you know, it's a little fancy and it's nice.
It's a fancy catered meal at a big event center.
Really nice event center.
Probably about 500 people there, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that. And it's a fundraising dinner for Littleton Public School. So it is packed with rich people, basically.
Yeah,
wealthy donors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we were at the scholarship table.
Right.
We were not the wealthy table, in case you were wondering.
We were the parents' table. But there's a silent auction. They had a live auction there.
Yeah.
Did you guys put any bids in?
No.
So how high were things going?
The highest, I don't know with the silent auction, but at the end of the night when they were just flat out, okay, now raise your paddle if you want to donate money. And it was, who wants to donate $10,000? And a guy raised his paddle for $10,000.
Hmm. Yeah, so that probably was the most.
That was the most.
Yeah.
But they were auctioning off like weekend getaways to different places.
People bid a lot for a house in California, a rental. But it was a beautiful, so leading up to this, the day had been very warm. And I want to say it was probably one of the warmest days we've had yet this spring.
Yes.
So it almost was like maybe 80 degrees that day, upper 70s, like beautiful, perfect weather. I had a pretty spring dress on. Sylvia had a pretty spring dress. We're walking.
We all park and walk in.
All the women have like lightweight, beautiful spring dresses. We're all laughing and having a good time. Outside, you know, we're all feeling special and fancy.
Right.
Walking in, you walk in, this is what I forget. You know, I forget that this happens because it's been a full year, maybe, I guess, less than that, than I've experienced it. We walk into there. The air condition is set to like 55 degrees.
Oh, it is an Arctic blast.
And as soon as you walk in the door. I felt like my skirt, my dress kind of lifted with the cold air.
Yeah.
We immediately, all the women start hunching.
So you're doing the Marilyn Monroe there as you walked in the entrance?
You do the Marilyn Monroe, except not sexy because it's frigid.
Right.
So it's the hunched shoulders, the clutching the arms, the warming of the air, the scowling, looking around. It was so cold in this event center, and it had been so nice that day. If they had just opened the doors, I don't know. There's no reason to have had the air condition on.
No, I have no idea. It's almost like we were back in Florida in the summertime and going to see a movie.
It was
where they
the first
the AC
warm
up.
Day.
The like, very first one.
Like, it's not like it's a string
it's
of a heat
wave. It's not something we're used to in Colorado. Not something they do out here.
No.
Crank up the AC.
Unless it's like we do have days, we'll sometimes have a week that's over 100. That's fine. I get to crank the AC.
Not the
when
first
it's that.
Warm day in spring.
No, it wasn't even a hot day. It was a warm day.
Right.
So it was miserably cold in there. We get through the dinner portion of it, and I see a group of people towards the back near what looks like hot beverages. So we get up and go down
to the
hot beverages,
the urn,
and there's a large guy back there with like a flak jacket on and a security written across his back, clearly with like, I don't know, Littleton's finest.
No, he was a police officer,
right?
Yeah. He was. He wasn't. Yeah, yeah.
But he was there. They had right, a table actually, yes. there.
They did have a table there.
And I don't know, but he was dressed in full like SWAT gear.
He did. He had a bulletproof vest on.
He had a bulletproof vest on.
He was a big, beefy, burly man.
Yeah, big guy.
What is Littleton?
Yeah.
Right? And they just had the 25-year
Oh, we did.
Anniversary.
Yeah,
Columbine,
but that's not Littleton Public School.
Within a week.
Well, right.
And he, that but, isn't Littleton?
And these no. cops weren't...
That's Jefferson County, Littleton.
But these cops weren't on duty. I mean,
no,
they were
there
they were
to
eating.
Have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the weird part about it.
Hmm.
And Columbine
understand.
Is in Jefferson County, right. so it's not in our little school district.
Yeah, it just seems real close to us, though.
Uh-huh. It is, yeah. yeah. I don't know that that's why they were there, but I mean, good thought. Mm-hmm. Things happen. But this guy, because I said, oh man, this, you know, I'm so cold. And he goes, I know. He's like, we're debating about whether there's a, like a hockey, an ice rink underneath this floor in yeah. here. He said he and the guys, all big burly guys, mm-hmm. were freezing.
Yep.
Hmm. Yeah.
They were wearing, the uniforms were short sleeved.
But he had a heavy duty.
But yeah.
And when you're big, you right. don't get as cold as maybe a smaller woman.
It
might.
Did make us feel better knowing that the cop was suffering.
It made
as well.
Me feel a lot better.
Oh, by the way, they put, you know, these big events, they come out, it's catered, you know, so they come out at the beginning and they put, the first thing they do, they put salads on everybody's plate. Now, there are, I don't know, 50 mm. tables in this place, maybe 75 tables.
A lot of tables.
Everybody gets a salad and everybody at the beginning, you're walking around seeing all the items up for bid at the silent auction, walking around. Well, the parents, I mean, I'm hungry. They had dessert set out there too. I first grabbed the dessert.
The dessert was set on the table.
Chocolate. Yeah. Why would you put the dessert out
so
there
Dave
at the very beginning?
Immediately to finish us.
It's like chocolate mousse with a cookie on top. I ate the whole thing. The whole place has their salads on the table.
I'm betting that was not the only dessert portion that you had that night.
No, that was it.
Oh, no, that was it.
I thought maybe you took somebody else's.
No, everybody ate
this. I did give him my topper.
But the interesting thing was, like, we all were hungry. The parents of the scholarship winners, we were all hungry, so we ate.
And we're also not going to be bidding on $500 whatevers.
But we all ate our salads, and then I got up to go over to the bar to get myself a Coke, and as I'm walking across, nobody else in the whole place had even touched their salad yet. Everybody's busy talking to all the other rich people, hobnobbing
it's
it up.
True.
Not a single 50 tables, maybe 70 tables, not a single other person had touched their salads.
But the scholarship winners.
All the poor kids and their parents had
hunkered down.
Hunkered down and finished our salads.
But here's the thing.
I was a little embarrassed.
When we say scholarship winners, it's not like it was given to us because we don't make a lot of money or it wasn't money
These
related
are merit-based
at all.
Scholarships.
It was a merit-based scholarship. Yeah. So there could have been a wealthy family. I don't know that there was, though, at our table. There wasn't.
Oh, right.
There
wasn't. That's true. No, yeah. There was not. No.
But we all hunkered down like it was the first free meal we'd ever been given in our lives.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to Sylvia.
Yes.
And congratulations to you as parents because I know, you know, you guys are the ones that made that happen one way or another.
That's right. Let's give ourselves a round of applause. It would have been nice if it was a full ride scholarship. But what I mean, let's not go crazy.
But what a great way to end
her
high school career.
It was absolutely fantastic. And the evening, so it's just fantastic evening, a lot of fun. It was great seeing her up there. They have a beautiful like 360-degree screen that wraps around the whole place and it was just super cool,
really high tech and fancy.
My highlight of the evening is we were leaving and there were a lot of people that came up and talked to us. Her band director was there, just
a state senator who was a parent of one of the kids that she works
came
with.
Up to meet her. They were so excited because they heard her name and they're like, oh, our daughter talks about Miss Sylvia, now we know who you are. So that was cool, like a lot of people coming up, so that was really wonderful. School principal did not come up.
Oh, you're right. That's so weird.
No.
Mm-mm. Huh.
It is weird.
I wonder why he wouldn't.
A lot of other people came up. Not him.
Yeah. Not him.
Anyway. so we're leaving. And so every table had a potted plant on it. And Dave did not know, but you could bid on the potted plant. Right. Purchase the potted plant.
How would I do? Andrew, would you know that?
No, I had read about it. No big deal. I'm just setting this up. I'm not accusing
you. All right.
If I hadn't read about it, I wouldn't know
you
about
wouldn't
it
know.
Either.
Right.
So there's a real dark corner, and I see a man standing by himself.
Looking forlorn.
Very forlorn.
Slumped shoulders.
And he's holding a potted plant, and it is our next door neighbor, Brian. Yeah, because his wife works for Littleton Public Schools. Right. But Brian is just standing in a dark corner, clearly waiting for his wife, holding the potted plant.
He just wants to get out of there.
It was such a great thing.
This was like a 3-hour-long ordeal.
Yeah, we wanted to get out of there, too.
I ran up to him. I'm like, Brian, what are you doing? What are you saying? A plant?
Dave,
what are you
stealing? Dave thought he was stealing a centerpiece.
I accused him of stealing a plant. It's like, no.
Yeah.
But it was fun seeing him just standing in the corner, biding his time.
Isn't that Brian?
The downtrodden husband waiting for his wife to finish.
Yeah.
Yakking it up.
It was really funny. She like kind of floated by and like gave me a wave. And then she saw that we were standing next to her husband. She goes, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw him the other day outside. I said, well, you got that potted plant? And he pointed out the window. He said, there it is, right in the front window. I said, looks good.
So it's kind of a small world in the Littleton Public School. It's a small district. Yeah. So it's nice to see people that you know. But Andrew, how have you been?
So it's been amazingly busy. 3 kids, like all this other stuff's going on. So
not,
I'm tell you,
not just busy.
I'm going to share. I mean, it really is amazingly busy.
Yeah. Okay.
Without the guy without a job.
So I'm going to share 2 stories with you. And I do have a business that I run, and that's been like so insane, the business that I run, that I don't know how, right? And let's just say my share of that business is worth north of $2 million, right? So I feel like I owe it to that business to give it a little TLC now and again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just glad that when things are kind of like, let's say, very hands-on there, that I've got some extra time to devote.
Sure.
To basically devote it. And that's also why I'm going to Maryland to work on some stuff. So I'm going to share 2 stories with you. So, you know, 15 years ago, my first wife, Rita, passed away from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
She was a school administrator. And, you know, and so I got to be a parent of a public school administrator. And I got to see the long hours, all the...
You got to be the husband of a public school.
I got to be the husband.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if your neighbor's wife is an administrator.
No, she's, I think she supports, special ed teachers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in any case, I created an award to honor my wife. And so every year we give the Rita Board Dowd Award to an assistant principal and a principal, in the school district in which she taught, which is Carroll County, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we, every year we go through this process, we get nominees. And I would say
it's a great thing that you do.
Yeah, it is.
In general, we have about 30 nominees, 15 assistant principals and 15 principals.
That's a lot.
And we meet to read the letters and read things. And some of these letters too, I mean, you know, there probably isn't a dry eye reading just all the work that the administrators do, the great lengths that they go to just really make things work.
A good administrator in a school is worth their weight in gold because there is a lot of bad ones out there. And when you get a good one, it is amazing.
Yeah. And so we created this award because there wasn't really any recognition for administrators, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we created this award because we felt like there's a vacuum. But anyways, tomorrow night, they're giving away the Rita Board Dowd Award.
Wow.
For the 15th year.
Wow.
So it's been 15 years already.
Hmm.
You know, and so we'll see what it is. So I'll get a link that I can actually watch the meeting because they stream it and stuff too. And this is also the meeting where they name the teacher of the year.
Oh, fun.
You know, for the county as well. Hmm. But as far as the administrators go, but we picked 2 very deserving people for the award. And I will say that the principal who's getting the award, he is actually the principal of a like a technical school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of nice that we're going to be recognizing him and in really a different community, like not just your standard community.
Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman, everybody basically said, is the fact that he can manage all these different personalities at this technical school. It's like, yeah, he really deserves the award for that. So I guess it's about a like strong engineering type. So that's one story I'm going to tell you ties in with the education.
Nice.
So I've also been taking the time to focus on my health. And my doctors wanted me to get all these tests and stuff done for years. So finally, it's like, well, I don't have any excuses anymore. Let me get the tests done. And I will tell anybody out there, you know, if you're thinking maybe I should take some time for myself, do it. Right? Don't ask questions. Don't apologize. Take some time for yourself. You know, focus on your health, focus on your well-being, do it, right? I mean, if you look
at... Are you telling everyone to quit their jobs?
You know, whatever that means to you, you can interpret it any way that you want to interpret it, but take some time for yourself.
I'm going
to
quit my job.
If you feel like...
Right? No.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah. If I'd ask my wife that question...
Would it have happened very quickly?
No, it wouldn't have happened. Yeah.
You just had to do it. So you're telling me I just have to do it. Got it. So got it.
In any event. So I had I was supposed to go see a pulmonologist Monday morning.
Hmm.
Monday morning, 7:30, right? I've got everything planned out.
So early.
Dropping the kids off at school early. And then the appointment is supposed to be 10 minutes away, right, from where I'm dropping the kids off. Well, I get a text message literally as the kids are getting in the car at like 6:40 in the morning that says, oh, by the way, your appointment isn't in the branch that's 10 minutes from your house. It's in downtown Denver.
Give me a break.
Right? And so I'm thinking...
You can't even get there. You'd have to leave right then.
Well, so I drop the kids off at school, and I'm basically telling them, I'm like, okay, get out.
Yeah.
Dashiell, you walk to the high school, get out.
Yeah.
And so then I take off.
Kicking them out the door.
And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to make it down there. I'll be 5 minutes late or whatever. So it worked out. I got down there. I walked in the doors, and it's a huge medical complex. It isn't one little office.
Mm-hmm.
It is essentially a hospital type place.
Yeah.
Huge. And so basically I get in the door. I pre-register online. Like I check in
online.
You've
done what you should have done.
I've done all the paperwork, everything. I've done it all online.
Yeah.
So I walk in the front door. I'm there by 7:30, right? So I'm there on time, ahead of time, whatever. There are 10 or 15 people waiting in line.
Oh, just to get the checked in and then to figure out where to go in the building.
So, you know, I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to go use the bathroom and I come back. So go bathroom, come back. By the time I come back, the line is gone, right? And I'm talking, I was gone maybe 3 minutes.
Okay.
So the line is gone. I go to check in and it's like maybe 7:35 when I go to check in,
mm-hmm.
right? And she's like, oh, our computers aren't working. I can't pull you up, blah, blah, blah. So she's fiddling around for like 5 minutes.
Oh no,
right?
Andrew.
Yeah. So anyways, so then she's like, you know, and I can see where this is going.
I can see where this is going. I feel stressed and angry right now.
So so basically and she's like, yeah, I don't think they're gonna see him. And I'm standing right there and she's talking
about you.
She's talking about me, and I'm like, yo, okay. And so she says, I'll call upstairs. And she's like, yeah, she's like, why don't you just go upstairs and talk to them? So now, by the time I get upstairs, because it's like, it's a slow elevator,
mm-hmm.
and by the time I go upstairs, it's 7:45, right?
Oh.
So I'm 15 minutes.
Do you have anxiety about this? No, I would have had anxiety.
Not anxiety.
I don't like being late.
Yeah, I get anxiety. No, I get anxiety about that.
I don't like being late at all, and I get real anxious.
Oh, and I don't like being late, but the thing is, I was there, and, you know, as far as like, I'm thinking, well, you know, I hope they're going to be reasonable about it. I mean, you know, it's 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's not like it's some small little office where you walk in and it's a receptionist.
And they're right there.
Like downstairs, there's probably 7 receptionists. I mean, we're talking, it's a huge facility.
Hmm.
Parking, I mean, was unbelievable there, right? I mean, if it was just a little, like, you know, parking lot and, you know,
no problem. I totally get what you're saying.
So, and it's not like they're located in downtown Denver.
Yeah.
Right? So in any case, she's like, well, it's 7:45 now. The doctor's not going to see you. You're going to have to reschedule. And I'm like,
oh, man.
You know, and I have to go through. I'm like, I was in the building by 7:30.
Yep.
Your guys had a computer problem downstairs.
You texted me at 6:40.
You know, should me having to use the restroom have been the difference as whether I make it? But it's almost like they're trying to find a reason.
Andrew, I don't know if you remember, but Sylvia had this thing happen where she went to one location, had to switch to another location, and the woman told her, oh, we're going to charge you $180. Did they ever charge? No, the woman lied.
Yeah, and I'll have to compare names of facilities with you after.
Yeah.
But so, you know, and I flew off the handle.
Yeah.
Right? There's all kinds of people waiting there. Nobody's rushing anywhere. I can tell you, those patients are in those seats.
Also, we wait for doctors for half of our life.
Yeah. So, you know, so as far as this goes, but I flew off the handle. I'm like, you got to be effing kidding me, you know? And I wasn't like ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly was not going to hide my displeasure.
Yeah.
You know, and then so she's like, well, we'll reschedule. And I wanted to just walk out the door.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, let's just see what you have to offer. I'm like, I waited 6 weeks for this appointment.
Pulmonary heart?
Lungs.
Oh, it's lungs. Yeah. Okay.
So I'm like, I waited 6 weeks.
Never mind.
I waited 6 weeks.
That's cardiology. I'm a dummy.
You guys are the ones that scheduled the appointment.
It's not a medical podcast.
Sorry.
So.
You know, halfway across town, like, and you didn't let me know about it until like the morning of the appointment.
That's absurd.
Yeah. So anyways, fortunately, they rescheduled it for Wednesday, tomorrow morning in Highlands Ranch. I mean, literally.
Well, that's what you know of right now.
It's on the street.
Where, did they switch it on you, or did you not like your original email?
They never said what the actual. And I called the Highlands Ranch location and made the appointment there.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So anyways,
is this Kaiser?
No. So anyways, I scheduled I got the appointment scheduled. It's all been rescheduled. So that's all good. But you know, I told the lady, I'm like, you know, I'm like, I'm glad that I'm rescheduling this with another doctor because I don't know that I'd want to go see a doctor that's not going to see me because, you know, I'm 5 minutes late walking in the door.
It's absurd. And they don't treat you like a real human being is what the problem is.
And that's where it comes down to. So like, I just don't know what my experience with a doctor would be if this is how they treat their patients. Now, subsequent to this, I talked to some elderly people that see doctors on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they go to like Anschutz Medical Center. And they said their grace period is 20 minutes. Right? Reasonable. 5 minutes.
20 minutes is acceptable.
Yeah. 5 minutes is
absolutely. And I think Sylvia had
ridiculous.
Called. We had all called. And I think she was under 10.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so people.
People are so
where's the
unforgiving.
Humanity?
It doesn't make any sense.
And it makes it so difficult for everybody. And then.
Also, like, maybe you have to wait an extra 20 minutes yourself before you get in. No big deal. You're already there.
Well, and. You know, if you go to a place too, and they say get arrive 20 minutes early. Well,
yeah, they do. I've
by the time
that.
You figure out the parking, the preliminary reception area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could be 10, 15 minutes right there. 20 minutes, like, wasn't really enough.
Yeah.
But that's all. I mean, that's all I had to give.
Yeah.
Now I talked to my primary doctor today, and I told him the story. He's like, I had another patient last week that had exactly the same issue there.
Wow.
And he's like, those guys are jerks. He said, but they're good at what they do.
Yep.
Oh.
You know?
So it doesn't matter.
That's too bad.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's my experience. Now, hopefully there's not a chapter two. I'll go tomorrow.
When do you go? You go tomorrow?
Yeah, and my appointment's at like 9. I'm dropping the kids off at 7:30.
Okay.
So, and literally, like, this facility is probably 3 minutes down the road.
And it's Highlands Ranch, which means it'll be an easy, like, the worst, a two-story.
Like, I bet you there's not even 3 turns from where I'm dropping the kids off. To where this building is. So
that's
I'm actually going to show up there like an hour early.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, there's no point in me driving home just to drive.
Yeah.
Just to basically drive back there. But, you know, as far as doctors, but yeah, and that's what I would say in general is, why can't people just be decent and human to each other?
And like, even just use your brain and like, okay, maybe there's a rule about it. Things can be flexible.
Well, and 5 minutes is just ridiculous.
I agree, especially in Denver. The traffic's terrible.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get on with the show.
And I say that the traffic's terrible. We don't live in Atlanta. We don't live in Chicago.
We're near.
You don't live in New York.
We're in a mid-sized
Los
city.
Angeles.
I'm allowed to complain. Dave's allowed to sneeze while I'm complaining.
Oh, wow.
Bless you.
There's a lot of pet fur in here. We need to get out to that snack shack. All right. Anyway, got a great guest for you, best-selling author Ellie Griffiths. She's got a new book out now called The Last Word. This book, set in Shoreham, Sussex, that's England, is so much fun. I really enjoyed it. It is part of the Harbinger Carr series, but works great as a standalone, as The Good Detective is not featured a whole lot. Instead, the main players in this book are Edwin, who is over 80 years old. He's an eccentric guy with a taste for solving mysteries. And Benedict and his girlfriend Natalka, who run a private investigation firm. Their new case involves a writer found dead, but her family believes it is a murder. So octogenarian Edwin, who is someone who loves to read the obituaries, believes that something fishy is going on because the man who wrote this writer's obituary has been dead for some time himself. The book has Edwin and Benedict going undercover on a writer's retreat to try to solve the case, which is a lot of fun. And really what I love about Ellie's books are the characters. She does a great job at creating real and interesting characters that are warm. And we just love to follow them. Really enjoyed reading this book. And as ever, love to chat with Ellie. So here now talking about her book, The Last Word. This is Ellie Griffin. You had to have the last word last night to know what everything's about. You had to have a white hot spotlight. You had to be a big shot last night.
Good, thank you. It's pouring with rain here, but never mind.
Well, we had snow and hail yesterday, but today is another beautiful day. So it's springtime in the Rockies. That's what you get.
Yeah. Yeah, and springtime in England as well, I guess. Sure. It doesn't sound as good, though, as Colorado.
I do see green. I see green behind you, that looks promising.
Mm-hmm. It is very green. I have to say it's very green.
That's good. Not green here. Not yet. We got to wait a few weeks. I remember when we went to London on a little trip a couple years ago, and we were standing
last
there.
Year.
But the one before that, when we were standing in the rain, I think we were getting ready to get on the water taxi, and it was just pouring rain. And the guy looks over, and we were talking about the rain. I don't remember how it came up, but an English guy looked over us. He goes, "Ah, this is our summer."
It's true. It's true. Just a sort of lighter rain.
That was also where Laura tried to. So we're getting on the water taxi, and it's funny because I was. This is a scene right out of your book because it happens in your book, where she's trying to. We're trying to figure out the pole there and the little tap to get in there, and the woman standing there. She goes to Laura. She said, "Just tap it. Just tap it." So Laura looks and just takes her hand and taps on the thing, and the woman just shakes her head. So, you know, it was quite a memorable trip.
There's nothing like that feeling, which I do have in the book, don't I, about just not being able to get through a door. And just you have it at airports as well, where you're waving your boarding card and just think, what? I don't understand.
Yeah. I know. The technology in the States at that point, it had not reached us. Right. And you guys had that credit card tapping and we didn't have it yet. I didn't know what that was.
It's funny how we always think of you as so far advanced.
Oh, you should not.
But I remember that, going to States and thinking, oh, that's not there. That, and you actually look very stupid tapping things. And
oh, that's probably true. That, the likewise could go. There we go. There we go.
Well, speaking of your new book, The Last Word, I absolutely love this book. It was so much fun reading this one. This is a tale of Wordle streaks, silver surfers, and flutes. Ellie, what was it that inspired you to write this book?
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you liked it. Yeah, The Last Word is a book about words and writing, and it starts off with Edwin, who calls himself the oldest sleuth in Britain, starting his day with yoga and Wordle and porridge, as I do, and then going to read the obituaries. And really, it was the obituaries that gave me the idea, because I had started to notice you would read about obituaries, you know, read about the dead person. And sometimes at the bottom, there would just be a line saying that the writer of the obituary had predeceased them. Oh. And I just thought, oh, what if that was a pattern? Right. What if obituary writers started dying? So that was the little clue that started, you know, you just have a small seed, don't you, that really grew into the whole book.
Are you a longtime reader of the obits then?
Well, I suppose I must be, actually. Yeah. I mean, and what I really like is in one of the papers, The Guardian, they have a page that's about ordinary people, you know, non-famous people, and that their children or friends put in a piece, and you just think, wow, people are wonderful and they've achieved so much in their lives. And so I do like reading them, but you also do, as I do in this book, I suppose, kind of notice the pattern of them. And you know, it starts off with when they're born, and then there's usually a long list of things they did, and then at the end it says who they're survived by. And one of the characters in my book, Benedict, starts sort of rather morbidly imagining his own obituary and thinking, well, who will I be survived by? So I guess it is a way of thinking about life and death and mortality in a way.
Yes, it is. It is.
As a writer, have you ever tried writing your own obituary? I'm sorry.
I haven't. I have to say, I think that would be a bit more difficult for me. But I have, you know, I have rather tragically sorted out all my Desert Island Discs and things like that, should I ever be asked on one of those shows. So it is quite interesting, sort of working out your life in terms of the songs you might choose. Or so I suppose I have a little bit thought about my life in that way.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That's good. You've gone further than I have.
Yeah. Me too, yeah.
And, you know, I couldn't have all eight Bruce Springsteen songs, so it'd be very difficult, but I think I've sorted it out.
You had to puzzle through it a little bit. I get you.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So in the book, The Last Word, a dead woman's notebook is found. And in this notebook, there are passages that make it sound like she's scared her husband is going to kill her, which he refutes, claiming it's just notes for a new book. And I'm curious, I'm sure that must have happened to you, where you've written something and people think like it's your real life. Has that happened to you?
Well, I think that is true of all writers in a way, isn't it? Because you write something and, you know, I've got my notebooks here next to me, and they're full of, you know, ideas for murders and who could kill who or how. And, you know, I'm sure if anyone were to read them, they would, you know, look at them in horror. But also, like Melody, the writer of my book, there are also moments where she's tried to work out Wordle in them and things like that. So and maybe little lists of things for supper and things like that. So a more a bit of a balance of life, really. But I guess people always as well a little bit think and ask you if, mm-hmm. if books are based on your real life. And I don't know what's more damning, really, if they are or if they aren't. Because if they are, well, that raises questions. If they aren't, means you've just imagined all that stuff, which is pretty scary. And so
that is true. That's true. It goes
but that
way,
is your
it?
Job. Yeah, that is your job.
It is my job. And I think in the Postscript Murders, which is a sort of prequel to this book in a way, I wrote about a woman called Peggy Smith, whose job was to think up murders for writers. And I think I said to you at the time when we chatted about that book that she was kind of based on my Aunt Marge, who was absolutely excellent at thinking up murders. And she was a very respectable lady, retired maths teacher and everything. But, you know, she was very good at that. So I think some people's mind just work that way.
Mm-hmm. What an interesting thing. Yeah, I like that. Was she a big mystery reader?
She was a very big mystery reader. And once she thought of a murder for me that involved a stairlift, you know, the kind of really fascinating can't use the stairs, a stairlift. And I did use it in the book. And I got a review, quite a good review. And I think it was in the Financial Times, actually. And it said, Ellie Griffiths has thought of the nastiest use of a stairlift I've ever seen. And my Aunt Marge was so proud that she had that framed. She was so proud.
Oh, that's great. That's so awesome.
She must have been so proud of you, too.
She was. Yeah, she really was. Really close to my Aunt Marge and to my mom. They were sisters. And sadly, my dad died before my books were ever published. So I was always very sad about that. But I was very happy that my mom and my Aunt Marge got to see them published and to have books dedicated to them and to give me their opinions, which they certainly did.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, that goes with the territory. Speaking of things, you know, ripped from your real life, a writer's retreat plays a big part in this book. And I'm kind of curious if I'm assuming maybe you've been on a writer's retreat, and I'm wondering, are they helpful? I picture them as like a bunch of people swilling wine and chatting, but I could be wrong.
You'd be absolutely right, Laura. I actually have never been on one as a writer.
Oh, I'm surprised.
Though I have taught at a couple as a creative writing teacher, not necessarily retreats. These were more sort of crime writing weekends. But they were in a very atmospheric country house called West Dean, which is in Sussex. And there is something about teaching at a very beautiful, quite remote place and sort of thinking of writing and thinking of words. It's quite an intense experience. So I think I did draw on that in this book, though I have to say that none of my students resemble any of the students in this book. but there is something about being in a beautiful, quite isolated place. And we would, at the end of the second day, we would in the evening, we weren't allowed to have a real fire. So we would put one of those fake fires up on my laptop and we'd sit around that and read our stories aloud. And actually was quite a lovely experience. But I do remember thinking this needn't be a lovely experience. It could be quite a spooky experience. And so it proves in the book.
Yes.
I always feel like they should have those writers' retreats in like a locked basement somewhere where you can't, you know, there's no distractions. You know, you're forced to sit there.
Although I do quite like getting my students to go outside and sort of doing a sound walk and actually those sort of distractions are really interesting because not until you get out in the countryside that you find it's really noisy. I think Edwin in the book is just horrified by the racket the birds make.
Yeah.
And you know, there's people crunching along the gravel, there's birds singing, there's sinister things happening in the woods, you know, gunshots quite often, birds flying off. So I think that's also very interesting, the things that you hear in a supposedly isolated place, and that also plays a role in this book.
That's interesting. Yeah,
what is something like, do you have like a favorite like piece of wisdom that you give your students when you're teaching writing?
Trouble is all creative writing teachers, I think, say the same things, and I'm probably absolutely responsible for saying the same things over and over again. But one of the things I say is don't wait for inspiration. You know, inspiration can come at the end, and that Picasso said the muse catches you working. Because I think sometimes people are just waiting for that perfect moment or that perfect idea, and actually just sit down and start writing. That's the advice I give. Although I've also had the experience like Benedict in the book, who really is a writer and loves writing, but he goes out in this beautiful country house and sits there and can't think of a single idea apart from what he's had for breakfast. So I do sympathize because I've had that too.
Right.
I don't know if you, do you have a thing that you say to your students, Dave?
Well, we teach, so I'm a theater teacher, and basically it's just, I always like to tell them to, you know, leave their inhibitions at home. You gotta be afraid or not afraid to take risks. It's all about risk taking in my class. So just kind of, and we do lots of exercises and play lots of games to remove those inhibitions. So that for me is a big, big part of it, and in the theater world.
I think that's one of the very thrilling things about acting. Yeah. Do that, is just wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about this character of Edwin. I loved Edwin. I love him. He's a great guy. He's the 84-year-old private eye who loves trailing people and taking secret pictures of them, which of course, you know, as a writer who's writing about people tailing other people, LA, and I know we were just talking like everything in your books isn't about you, but have you ever tailed someone in the name of research? Of course. I mean, not you're like you're stalking anyone, but I would think you want to, are you a method writer in that way?
Not really. I think a lot. I think I really do like making things up, and I'm so glad you like Edwin because he's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the strange things about writing and probably about acting too, actually, is that I feel I can really inhabit Edwin, even though, as you say, he's an 84-year-old man, which is not me. You know, he's a former BBC producer. He's gay. He lives in a little Sussex town, which he kind of slightly despises, and which is he was in London, though in this book he goes back to London and finds it not quite what he expected. But I really love the idea, though, talking of the secret pictures, of the idea that Edwin is actually very good with his mobile phone and with technology.
Right.
Yet he gets a lot of fun out of asking me, "Oh, I can't quite. How do I take a selfie? I don't quite understand." And while the sort of patronising younger person has explained to him how to use his phone, he's taken several clandestine pictures of the group.
Yeah.
So I quite like turning that on its head. Really, the fact that, you know, Edwin is pretty good with technology, and he says, you know, his age is like a cloak of invisibility. People don't notice him, and he notices a lot. So I sort of enjoyed that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you call him in the book, the Silver Surfer. What a great great nickname for him. Yeah. So I'd slap my knee at that one. Now, you mentioned writing retreats. There's also a lot of book club talk in this one as well. I loved Edwin's observation that he, quote, doesn't want to sound pretentious or not pretentious enough, which was hilarious. What are your thoughts on book clubs?
Well, I have belonged to several book clubs, and actually I have really enjoyed them because I think they do make you read things way outside your comfort zone. And like a lot of people, I read a lot, but I end up reading a lot of the same thing, and I reread a lot, which I love. But I do like being sort of thrown out of my comfort zone. So in fact, C.J. Samson, who's one of my favourite writers, I only discovered because he was a book club choice. Oh. But having said that, there is a whole minefield about book clubs, isn't there? Because first of all, you choose your book. Is it going to be a good enough book? Are people going to think it's, you know, literary enough or too literary or too pretentious? As Edwin says, not pretentious enough. Right. Or how much do you talk about the book? How much you just talk about your love life and you know, your families and things like that? How much wine do you drink? There's so many hidden traps in a book club. And, of course, the book club that Edwin goes to in this book is, in the end, without giving too much away, a very sinister book club indeed.
Yeah.
And their choices do kind of reflect that as well. Though they do get to read The Leopard, which is a book that I love.
Oh, good. Is it fun for you to include, like, you know, authors that are friends of yours? Do you go out of your way to do that kind of thing? Put their books in your books?
I don't know that I have done that. I do have somebody in this book, I think, reading Lisa Jewell book, and that Lisa Jewell is a friend of mine. Right. So I think she gets a bit of a shout out. I think that's in the library. And someone's leaning on a pile of Richard Osman's.
Yes,
and somebody said to me, why that? And you know, I think Richard Osman's great. He's a very nice guy as well, but he sells lots of books, so there are piles of them everywhere.
Yeah.
So I think that's why there's no intended snark in the fact there's a pile of the books.
Oh, that's really funny.
No, I didn't take it to be snarky at all.
No, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, we talked to him. He's a really nice guy.
And actually, I think he's got a lot of people to read the kind of cozier side of fiction, crime fiction, who wouldn't have otherwise. So actually, I think he's a thoroughly good thing. The only bad thing I would say about him is that I'm 5'2", and I had a photo taken with him on a panel, and I just looked thoroughly ridiculous.
We've only seen him this way, so I didn't realize he was tall.
He's really tall. Some people would say I'm not very tall, but he really is tall.
You need to get yourself an apple crate to stand on like they do in the movies or something.
I so should have, or just had the sense to sort of move nearer the camera or something. Yeah. But as it was, it looks a slightly stretched.
That's really funny. That's adorable, though. I like that. You have a quote in the book from the DI, which she thinks to herself, quote, authors mean trouble. Which I thought that was funny because they kind of do. And I'm wondering if you think that's the case.
Oh, thank you for remembering that quote. Yes. Well, I think in the terms of Harbinder Kaur, who's the one who says that, of course, to her, they do mean trouble because in both in The Stranger Diaries and Postscript Murders, she's come across rather murderous authors. So I think there's no doubt. I think at one point she says, should she read before bed? No, she shouldn't do anything that dangerous. So I think she just goes on her phone and plays a game or something like that. So I think that's probably more her than me, but I think there's no doubt that authors are interesting people, and interesting people are always trouble in a way. But I have to say that I've always found actually the crime writer community to be a very kind and caring one, really very collegiate. We are all sort of on the same side, a bit like I was saying about Richard Osman. When one of our number, you know, does really well, we actually all feel quite pleased for each other. So I've heard tell, and that I couldn't possibly, you know, say more than just passes on, that the same's not always true of the romance writing community. But this is the rumor. But
the rumor. Okay, all right. I see you making the air quotes.
You know, it's just a rumor. I'm just passing it on.
I like that.
But certainly, crime writers, in my experience, have been very generous. Actually,
we had some bad press about, maybe it was last summer, with a romance writer who was accused of massive plagiarizing. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm. I don't remember the exact case, but I do remember actually a case that I sort of reflect in this book of a romance writer who was found to be with a woman's name, found to be an elderly male vicar. And so I do have a character a bit like that in this book. And I think in some ways people feel very betrayed when they find out that the pseudonym is not who they thought it was. Though, of course, people are always free to use pseudonyms.
That's true. Sure. That's true.
You know a thing or two about that.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I mean, speaking as somebody who has a pseudonym myself, and of course my real name, and you know, I think we talked about this before, because my real name is Domenica De Rosa.
Yes.
And my agent thought that was too romantic for a crime writer. And the funny thing was that she also thought it sounded made up. So she wanted me to make up a name that sounded more real than my real name, which is kind of...
That's hilarious.
It does sound made up, though.
It's a really strange thing. But in fact, I chose Ellie Griffiths, which is my grandmother's name, so it wasn't entirely made up.
Oh, that's what a good idea.
But it does make me laugh to think that my pseudonym is so much more believable than my real name.
That's pretty funny. So in the book, of course, we have Natalka is back. Now, she is Ukrainian, and we see her deal with the issues going on in her home country. Did you go back and add that in as the problems were persisting in Ukraine?
Well, you know, it's a very strange thing, because obviously Natalka appears as a main character in The Postscript Murders, which I wrote in 2018, which is before the current invasion of Russia into Ukraine. So it was before that situation happened. So in a way, I chose her to be Ukrainian because I wanted her to have some reason why she couldn't go home, and to have some reason why her brother would not be in contact with her brother, or that he could be involved in a prisoner exchange. All those things seem to work. So, and clearly anyone Ukrainian would tell you the situation's been going on, you know, much longer than we think it has.
That's true.
But it is quite a strange thing that I had created the Ukrainian main character when I came to write this book, which is in some ways a follow-on from The Postscript Murders. I had a Ukrainian character, and Ukraine were at war. And so obviously that had to be a central part of the book. But another really strange thing is that my sister, who lives nearby, has sponsored a young Ukrainian woman to come over here to England, sort of escape Ukraine. And she lives with my sister and has become a member of our family, really. She's a lovely woman. And the last word's dedicated to her. She's called Daria. But the strange thing is, and Daria wouldn't mind me saying this because I've told it to her, she's really like Natalka. So I had already created this character, Natalka.
Oh, wow.
And along comes real life Daria, who is a maths whiz, who looks a bit like Natalka, who does yoga, has all these things in common with her. So I think probably she has now slightly informed the character. And of course, we've also become friendly with Daria's mother, who has introduced us to all the food that you get in the book. So I think all the food in Ukrainian culture has been influenced by Daria and her mother, Victoria. So it is a very strange thing, and that I created a Ukrainian heroine, and then I met her.
Oh, it's so strange.
What if all your fictional characters start coming to life and invade your own personal life?
Huh? Yes.
Wouldn't that be strange? That would be a great... I don't know who I'd want to meet. I think I'd want to meet Edwin.
Yeah, you got to meet Edwin.
It's an interesting thing, Dave. That's a good thing to think about.
Think about that. Yeah. Write that book. I'm going to need you to write that book now.
Okay. Yes.
That could be an interesting one. That could be a... you could reference yourself.
Right, exactly.
Yes, and you wouldn't necessarily like all your characters. I mean, I guess in a way, like sometimes people say when you have a dream, don't they? Oh, everyone in a dream is yourself. So if you dream about your mother, you're dreaming about the motherly side of you. Mm. So maybe all the characters are me. And what if I get them all? That would just be too frightening.
I like that. Yeah. And then I like introducing Ellie Griffiths, but then it would be a different Ellie Griffiths than you, because you are Dominique.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's
true. Course.
Oh,
yes.
Man.
That would just get too meta.
I know it is too meta. You'd get stuck in an endless loop.
Yes, you would.
It works for Anthony Horowitz. It could work for you, too. Come on.
I love those Hawthorne books.
Those are great.
And I love the way that the Tony character, who's Anthony Horowitz, is not terribly clever and gets it all wrong. I love that. I'm doing an event with Anthony, who I know a little bit, at Capital Crime later on this year, and I'm so looking forward to chatting about that, because I just think that's such a funny conceit.
He's so great.
Another,
so smart.
So funny.
And another nice guy. We've talked to him a couple of times.
He's really nice
guy.
Yeah. I love his children's books too. And actually, if you see him with an audience of kids, he's just amazing, because he has so much time for them, and he's just got such a rapport with them. It's lovely to see.
I bet. You are well liked too, because I always see other Rife writers referencing you. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious too, because I think I asked you this before, like if you get recognized in your grocery store. But have you ever seen people reading your book like out in public on a plane and then introduce yourself, or you just steer clear?
I have occasionally. I mean, it hasn't happened to me that often. Mm-hmm. And I haven't often been recognized, really. I live in the same, you know, small town just outside Brighton, where I've always lived, really. But of course, people here know me as Domenica. So I do often get recognized, but by people I was at school with, you know, not as yeah. Ellie Griffiths. But I've occasionally seen people reading my book, and I usually don't say anything. Because what if I was to say to them, "Oh, you enjoying that?" And they were like, "No, not really."
I know.
You can't run that risk.
Once my husband and I were on a plane and somebody was reading an Ellie Griffiths book, and he said, "Oh, are you enjoying that?" And luckily they said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Well, Ellie's right here." And I was a tiny bit embarrassed and a tiny bit pleased.
Sure, that's absolutely awesome.
I know. I feel like you got to kind of like sidle up to them like, "Hello."
I did once see somebody buying my book in a shop, and I said to them, "Oh, do you like me to sign that?" And they were like, "No." As if they thought I was obviously some random person who wanted to sign people's books. Luckily, the person selling the book was in Waterston, said, "Oh, actually, that's Ellie Griffiths. You can sign the book for me."
That's really funny.
Yes, get away from my book with your horrible pen.
I know. That's really funny. I happen to have a pen here.
Yeah, that's right.
I happen to just be signing all the books.
Yeah. In the book, Benedict, who's, you know, a secret aspiring writer, he's having issues because he doesn't know how the police actually go about solving crimes, which I feel like if I ever tried to write a crime novel, that would be a big issue for me as well. But I know a lot of writers have police or a cop on retainer. Do you have someone you go to ask, like a retired detective or something?
Yes, I do. He's called Graham Bartlett, and he was the chief superintendent of Brighton and Hove, which is where I live, and has advised several authors, really. And he's written, first of all, written nonfiction about being a detective, and has actually written really good, now some really good fiction. The first one is called Bad for Good.
Oh, wow.
I really, really recommend his books. Oh. Yeah, so Graham has always advised me, and he's, actually hasn't always advised me. He advised me from about my third crime book onwards. Because you can tell, because from that moment on, there's a lot more police procedure because I learned about it before. It's all a very vague. But Graham is great because he's also a writer. He's also a very nice man. He will adapt his advice to your book. So, for example, in the Ruth and Nelson books, I would say, "Could this happen?" And he'll say to me, "Well, strictly speaking, it shouldn't work like that, but I can see how Nelson would do it like that." So he is pretty good about that. So obviously, as every writer says, all the mistakes are mine and they are all mine. But Graham has really, when you talk to someone who's done the job, it does give you great insights into, for example, the huge team that's there that you really can't do justice to in a book. But I do in this book, at least, have Harbinder talking to a civilian analyst, and there's really this sort of massive, massive team there. It's not just a few people. Graham is very interesting on interviewing techniques as well.
Talking of
retreats, I teach this creative writing weekend, which is crime fiction, with my very good friend Leslie Thompson, who's a great crime writer. And the last day we have Graham come in, and there's police tape across the door, and there's, you know, the outline of a body on the floor. And Graham says, "There's been a murder. We have to investigate it." And as part of it, he interviews Leslie and I as suspects. And I tell you, it's terrifying, absolutely terrifying. I think I confessed in the first 2 seconds. So I'm, you know, it's easy enough to brag.
Wow, that sounds really helpful and informative.
Well, it is very interesting, and as a writer, when you to sort of see how the interview unfolds. And as I say, Graham is a very pleasant, soft-spoken man, so he has a very gentle way in interviews. But he'll get you. Yes, yeah.
Oh wow, yeah. Always ask for your lawyer. Always ask for a lawyer.
Yes, yes. and then given he says he can imagine giving a no comment interview, and that always makes you sound so guilty in my book. But
right, you know,
but it's as long as the police ask the questions. They don't mind that, because if they've asked the questions, and they can bring them up again when it comes to court. Huh. So I've tried. It's quite a difficult thing to write in an interesting way. I know, comment interview, but I think I had one in Bleeding Heart Yard.
Yeah. Oh, that's really funny. That's interesting.
Now, where's the cat? You have, speaking of snark, you had a little snarky remark about your cat in the at the acknowledgements. I thought that was really funny. You're like, I couldn't do it without you. I could do it without the cat.
He's not here at the moment. He was here, but he doesn't like the rains. He's gone into the house. So I had this cat, and I think we talked about this before. I had this cat called Gus, who lived to be 18 and was my constant companion. And he was, you know, he was like a copy editor. He looked at, I got the idea that he knew everything that was going on. He would put his foot on the keyboard and put some little comment. So he was the muse. And then sadly he died at age 18 and we were devastated. But then we adopted a kitten called Pip, who really is not the editor that Gus was. He's adorable and we all love him. But he is just not the brain that Gus was. So Pip is delightful at running around the garden trying to catch butterflies and looking cute. That is really his thing. But so far, he hasn't been a lot of help with the writing. But maybe even with, like, you know, authors have to do those slightly cringy box opening things where you open your box and you're, oh, look, it's my book. And Gus was so good at those. He would look interested. Oh. He would look at the book. He'd look up at me. It was great. It was lovely little scenario there. But Pip, he gallops all over them. He gets his back dirty feet on the books. He looks the wrong way. He needs a bit of work. But you know, we'll get there.
Yeah, you train him. He's young.
He's young, yeah.
It takes cats a while sometimes. We have a cat who we thought, oh, this cat. And he's, you know, at 10 years of age, he's finally come into his own. It took him 10 years, though.
I think that might be the story with Pip, but that gives me hope. Yeah, he's a very sweet boy. Very
really funny. I'm gonna have to look for him in your unboxing videos, because that actually sounds like it could be a funny unboxing video.
There are a few. He's also very cute looking because he has like a little white moustache, a bit like Hercule Poirot. So he has the looks. He has it all going on for him. So he just has to work a bit more.
Gotta put it together
on the acting.
Well, Ellie, listen. Loved your book, The Last Word. Love all your books. They're just so much fun to read, and you're just so much fun to talk to. We really appreciate you taking some time to chat with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been lovely to chat once again. Thanks so much.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Enjoy your day. Stay out of that rain. Get an umbrella or something.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
The Inside Flap. All right. There you go. Thank you so much to Ellie Griffiths for joining us. And let's go ahead and open it up, shall we?
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Flora Medicus.
She comes from Silver Spoon, Golden Rule, private school, never miss Sunday church.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called The Familiar. It's by one of my favorite fantasy authors, Leigh Bardugo. Bardugo? Don't know. She created the Grishaverse and some other stuff. She's awesome. You know, if she puts a book out, I will read it.
Yes.
So this one is brand new.
Did you say?
It's called The Familiar.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a standalone. So it's not a series. It's one and done. I absolutely loved it. So this is something unusual. Yes.
So with the title, The Familiar. So I figure this can go one of two directions. Mm-hmm. So it's either going to go magical.
Oh, yeah.
Or it's going to go in the direction of, you know, a familiar, somebody, you know, that knows you quite well. So I'm just wondering what direction.
Well,
it's going.
Me tell you the genre, and then you'll know.
Yeah. Ah.
So it's historical fantasy.
Hmm. Ooh, historical fantasy.
Which, right?
Yeah.
I know. Huh. I have not read a lot of historical fantasy. I didn't know it was a genre, but I've read one thing. I don't know. You guys may have read this book too. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay, that qualifies as historical fantasy.
Wait, have we all read that book?
Probably, yeah.
I've read it.
Yeah.
There you go.
It just doesn't happen that often.
Well, you don't read fantasy, but Andrew and I will cross over sometimes.
That's true.
Yeah, I do love fantasy. Mm-hmm. So I like this genre. I'm all in. I like magic and I like history. So I'd probably
There you go.
I probably should look for more. When I say I like history, I like stories. So I like
historical
fiction.
You like
fiction.
Stories set in
fiction.
History. Not you don't like history.
No.
I mean, I'm not going to take you to East High School and have you sit in on a history class anytime soon.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. So this book is set in late 16th century Madrid, which also is fascinating because there's not a lot of books set in Spain either, fiction books in Spain.
No, that's true. Anyway. I know that because I looked for some when we were planning our trip there.
It was incredibly hard to find books set in Spain. I don't know why. So this book is set during the Inquisition in Spain, and it centers around a servant named Luzia, L-U-Z-I-A, Luzia. Not sure. So Luzia can do magic and she sings the magic. So the bread gets burnt. She can sing the burn away. Mm. A glass breaks. She can sing it back together. Her mistress, who pretty much owns her in this 16th century Spain, finds out that she has magic. She kind of tricks her into repairing this dress magically. And she turns Luzia into a parlor trick. So her mistress is someone who wants up in the world of Spain, and this is her. She thinks this is her way to get it. So very quickly, higher up in the King of Spain's court, this is a man who is on the outs with the king. He wants back in with the king. He discovers Luzia at a dinner party, and he sees her as his chance to get back in the good graces of the King of Spain. Luzia is fine with that because he's her chance to get out of her miserable servant's experience. Hmm. She wants a life of luxury, which she thinks she deserves. Like, she's an interesting character. She's like, yeah, this, I like living nice. I like to have a bed to sleep on. I want this.
Right.
So it's a win-win for both of them, she thinks. She's also intrigued by a man who's in the hire of this guy. A man who may or may not be magical.
Oh.
Perhaps he is a familiar. He might be an amplifier of magic. His nickname is the Scorpion. And he may or may not be immortal. Don't want to give too much away. But I will give this away. He does happen to be good looking.
Shocker.
I know. So surprising, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Mm-hmm. So, I know. So, Luzia starts performing before bigger... And bigger. Before bigger and bigger audiences, they set up a series of games between her and three other people in Spain who have magic to find out who's a winner. That's kind of exciting. I like the games.
Sorry.
What are you doing?
Continue.
So, you know, I got to say here, Hank.
What is he doing?
Hang on.
It's the games.
Well, here's the thing.
What am I doing wrong?
Observations. Okay. No
so
explanation.
So you mentioned the Spanish Inquisition.
Oh.
So really, I had to get on YouTube, and now if I don't play this, I'm going to burst. So I had to do...
Okay. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition!
Okay, there you go. That's,
thank you.
I mean, I couldn't continue
it's okay.
on
it's okay. I
listening
get it.
To your review.
I was surprised it hadn't burst out earlier with one of you two.
Yeah.
Because you're both
Nobody
nerds.
Expects the Spanish Inquisition.
You're both nerds, and I was expecting it. And then I didn't get it,
That's
so
right.
I didn't know what had happened.
I think Dave's a bigger nerd than I am.
Oh, yeah. In many respects, yes.
Oh, it's really
Monty
funny.
Python nerd from way back.
There you go. All right, so there's these games. Before the Spanish Inquisition.
When I just now, and here's the thing, here's the sad thing, is I just now got that joke. I never really understood the joke. Because, you know, when someone is getting grilled about something that they don't want to be grilled about, they say, well, I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. And yet, and then now here three guys dressed as the Spanish Inquisition pop in and say, nobody expects the... That's the joke. I never really got the joke.
Well, you wonder what the origin of that is. If the origin even predates... Monty Python.
One expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah,
if they started it.
I'm sure Monty Python started it.
I don't know. We're going to have to research that.
You never know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing new under the sun, said Shakespeare. all right. So Luzia also has to hide. She has a hidden Jewish heritage. And these are something that you needed to hide during this era in Spain's history.
Yep.
So I'm typically, you know, sucked into Leigh Bardugo's books immediately. This one did take me a little bit longer to get into. But once I was in, I was in. So I wouldn't call it a slow burn because it's not a slow book at all. I just, it took a little bit longer. I think because it's historical fantasy genre, so there was not as much of the fantasy that I was used to.
Yeah.
And it was a little more historical fiction-y at the beginning, but then it quickly turns into the fantasy. So loved it. I know we talk a lot about the technological age. I talk about it and how much it just isn't great. And I'd love the technology just to go all away sometimes, but I would not want to be in 16th century Spain.
Nope. I don't think so.
Our age looks pretty good.
Yeah. All right.
So it's called The Familiar, The Magical Familiar. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo.
Very good. Recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week,
Dave Medicus.
It's a bonfire. Turn the lights out. I'm burning everything you motherfuckers talk about. It's a bonfire.
Is titled The Other Side of the Wall by Andrea Mara. Now, this is a brilliant, absolutely brilliant Irish psychological thriller that is character-driven, it is full of twists, it is fast-paced, and kept me instantly and intensely engaged. In fact, I lent this one to Sylvia, and she gobbled it up as well. And speaking of Sylvia, it was very exciting because this book, there are two main characters. One of them, named Sylvia, the other one is named Kate. Well, of course, which is my sister's name, which Andrew just called Sylvia. He could just call
her.
Well,
he called her Katie.
Okay, Katie. Yeah. Ah, I see.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's all right. I call the dog. I call everybody Sylvia, yeah. It seems like.
Right. Yeah. My kids, I never get the right name.
Yeah.
No.
So no. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it with
it's like
the
you're
three.
Grabbing. It's like you're grabbing the first syllable and it's not the right one.
No, I don't know how you do it with three. And you've got three pets, right?
Four pets.
Yeah. Four pets. Oh, I forgot. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I'll do it to a student every once in a while, and they get so angry. You learn, really, you can't do that. This book. Oh, yeah. And not only that, there's also a character named Laura in it.
I know.
It's Kate's mother. Huh. Sylvia.
The Medicus women.
Just needed a Mary, but there were no Marys in there.
That's
we had a Sylvia, a Kate, and a Laura. So we first meet Sylvia, a woman who believes that she saw a young girl lying face down in the pond next door. She runs over to talks to the guy next door and is immediately embarrassed, saying, "I think I saw a young girl lying face down." He's like, "Well, what are you talking about?" So nothing comes of that. Now, she also believes that there are strange things happening in her house late at night. Things she can't explain, like objects that appear in different places, or she's hearing strange noises. In fact, she becomes convinced that someone is entering her family's house at night. And especially this lent a little more credence when her young child wakes up one night screaming about a man in her room. She also hears a man crying through the wall next door, hence the title, The Other Side of the Wall. Now, she's got a lot going on, including a local child who has gone missing that she's worried about. Plus, at work, there appears to be a large sum of money missing from one of the accounts that she manages. Meanwhile, next door, we have Sam. Now, Sam seems to be spending a lot of time away from his wife and kids at work. And he's also engaging in text messaging with a woman that he keeps hidden from his wife, and that's Kate. And Kate is a bored mother and frustrated by a husband who doesn't seem to want to have anything to do with her. Sylvia, despite finding the husband very nice and charming, well, let's just say her hackles are raised. Now, this is a novel that switches point of views a lot, which I loved. It also switches back and forth in time, which I really enjoyed. The tension and the drama grow and grow throughout the read, and this is just kind of what kept me going, the suspense that builds to just an unbelievably exciting third act. I, like I said, I had our daughter, Sylvia, read this one, and she stayed up way too late reading it. But, you know, that's a sign of a great book, which this one is, The Other Side of the Wall by Andrea Mara. Andrew
Dow.
This bed is on fire with passion and love. What do you got for us this week?
So my book is I can't even remember what this is called, but it's fantasy.
Okay. I know, it's the genres. Andrew and I like to do the genres.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha, yeah.
So okay. This is called The Unintended Cultivator. Huh. It is written by Eric Dontigny, D-O-N-T-I-G-N-E-Y. And this book has a 4.61 on Goodreads.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah.
So this is, you know, if you're looking for a good book to read, I've already read the second book in the series.
Massive.
There's a third book out. Hmm. So I'll have to get that one. And so, you know, the main character of this book, his name is Sin.
What's the name of it again? I'm sorry.
Unintended Cultivator.
It's a different name.
Yeah. So the main character's name is Sin. He is a street urchin, orphaned. Like, you know, he doesn't know where he came from. He doesn't know anything. But basically, he's living on the street, surviving by his wits. You know, and that is basically Sin. He, you know, he is constantly being bullied by the children of the nobles who'd look for him and are basically looking to make his life miserable.
Hmm.
Right. And he's literally living from the scraps he finds in trash cans. You know, and that is Sin's existence. That's where the book opens up. Now, what is a cultivator, you might ask?
Yeah, I'm curious. And
what is a cultivator?
Yeah. And so,
and how does one get to be an unintended one?
Makes me think of gardening.
Yeah, and so in the magic world, this isn't the first book that uses the term cultivation.
Hmm.
And so a cultivation is a technique that magic users use to basically strengthen their ability to do magic. And it's kind of like a meditation, but where you can kind of see inside your body. And you can actually, like, cleanse your body. You can actually fine-tune your body. You know, think of a mechanic that's, like, looking at a car engine and examining a car engine, but look at that as far as meditating. And, like, if you could meditate and actually really physically look inside yourself, you can do that. And so that's the technique of cultivation.
Hmm.
But the technique of cultivation, again, it's not unique to this genre. You find it a lot of times in magic books, the cultivation and cultivators, you know, it's basically how you strengthen your magic. And so in this book, a cultivator is a magic user. They can approach the power of gods, and they can even become gods. If they get good enough, they can even transition to basically become gods. Now, for Sin, you know, magic initially isn't a big part of his life, right? He doesn't know that he has magic,
uh-huh.
But he does. But a cultivator comes to the town, and the cultivators are so far above everybody else that everybody else is like an insect compared to a cultivator. They live for hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years, extremely powerful. And so this cultivator comes to the small town on his way to go somewhere to do some deep cultivation, right? And he happens to observe Sin as he is trying to hide from the bullies of the nobles. And what he sees makes him curious, because what he sees is that when Sin hides himself, he is actually hiding his entire essence, right? And that can only happen if he has some sort of magic. Now, does Sin's magic work like everybody else's magic?
Oh,
well,
dear.
Please don't hold us in suspense any longer. Dear. I got to find out.
It doesn't.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Hold on a second. You are kidding me.
So,
that's insane.
So this powerful cultivator decides to take Sin under his wings and basically take him and make him a cultivator. Now, everybody else in town, all the nobles, are pissed off because they're like, well, why does he deserve to be a cultivator, right? And it isn't a question of him deserving it. It's a question of the cultivator sees something special in Sin, right? The cultivator, and we'll get to his name, and actually I'll just tell you, the cultivator's name is Feng Ming, right? And Feng Ming is an extremely powerful cultivator, and there are three cultivators in the book, which I will quickly get to that. So Sin is being taken to this fortress where Feng Ming wants to cultivate, right, to become stronger. So what ends up happening is there are three strong cultivators. I mean, we're talking maybe some of the strongest cultivators, legendary, in this area. I mean, they're to the point that other cultivators hear of these three names and they are afraid, right? Like, if you name drop one of these names, I mean, people are going to be running for the exits. And so what Feng Ming likes is that Sin is not some spoiled noble. He is a young, smart, hardworking kid who has had absolutely no good luck or no good fortune, and Sen is an extremely good student. And so Sen ends up learning from Feng Ming, who he calls Ko Zhong Long, who's Uncle Ko, and then Auntie Kahong. And so he ends up learning from all three of these almost godlike cultivators. And he soaks it all up, and he can do some amazing things, and he starts to actually blend their techniques. Mm. And so the first book is really, it's the discovery of Sen, and I have to be careful because, like, if I read, like, two books, I'm not sure where one stops and the other one starts. But the first book really is, the first part of it is his life on the street. Then he's discovered. Then he has training. Then he goes into sort of a testing phase where basically they're like, well, we've taught him. And what he needs to know now is he doesn't have that killer instinct. He has to learn the killer instinct, because in this world, the thing with the cultivators are they're all trying to size each other up. I'm more powerful than you. And they'll compete with each other. And they compete with each other by trying to kill each other.
Mm.
And so, you know, Uncle Ko, Auntie Kahong, and Feng Ming, they realize that, you know, Sen doesn't have the killer instinct and he has to learn it. So after they teach him a little bit, he goes out and he has to do some testing. So he gets out in the wilderness and he has to figure out how to survive. And there's mixed feelings in that as far as sending him out, but they realize, you know, it probably is the best way for him to learn. He needs to feel fear. He needs to feel threatened. And then after the testing, he goes back to Feng Ming, Uncle Long, and Auntie Kahong. And basically, they prepare him, and now he's ready to go out on his own. And, you know, there's more to this book. Like, the first book really creates a foundation. The second book is really more about Sen being out in the world and what he's experiencing. And it starts to bring back what is now his family, because Sen is really the adopted son that they never had. And I will say that Feng Ming, Uncle Long, and Auntie Kahong, they could become gods, but they're kind of waiting to make the transition. And maybe one of the pieces that's missing for them to make the transition to gods, Sen maybe, maybe they want to leave a legacy behind, and maybe Sen is their legacy. But, you know, it's a great book, and I just discovered tonight that third book is now available.
Oh, very exciting.
Of course, it might just be the pre-announced, because I know if you find that, you like look, oh man, I want to read this book, and it's like, oh man, it's not available for 3 months.
Yeah.
But I did see the third book is available, but is it available?
Oh, or is it pre-order? Or
yeah,
something?
Or is it pre-order? But the book is called Unintended Cultivator by Eric Dantigny.
Hmm. All right, and that is recommended by
Andrew Dowd.
And that brings us to the audiobook of the week, and that my pick this week is titled Malignant by Anita Waller, narrated by Bronwyn Price. This is a fantastic psychological thriller set in England. I found this to be a unique story in that I thought it was going to go one way, but midway through it, instead of zigging like I thought it would, it zagged, which caught me by surprise. Always good when you're reading a psychological thriller be caught by surprise. Yes. This is a story of two women, Claudia and Heather. Now, they've been friends for a long, long time with one thing in common. Neither one of them can stand their husband. One is a hopeless drunk. One is an abuser. So what do? They decide to leave their husbands and move into an apartment together. Sounds easy? No. Unfortunately, in the middle of all this, Claudia is diagnosed with a terminal illness, and there are I don't want to give a whole lot away, but some misfortunes that befell some characters and throws a big monkey wrench into the women's plans. I found this to be not just a riveting thriller, I found it to be beautifully written, emotionally wrought, well-crafted, and I just can't tell you how much I was on the edge of my car seat listening to this one. It is dark as well. It's devious. It's twisty. And that ending, that has one of the more, let's just say, interesting endings. A very memorable one, and it will leave you in shock. But let's take a listen to a clip. This is Malignant by Anita Waller, narrated by Bronwyn Price.
Paul Quentin leaned forward and stared into her face. He had seen this reaction so many times and knew the questions would happen next time he saw her. He was wrong. Claudia lifted her head, which was now feeling far too heavy for her to support it, and fixed her eyes on him. How long do I have? It was hospital policy to answer every patient truthfully and openly, and he hated it. Without treatment, 6 months at the most. As I said, it is very aggressive. And with treatment, 9 months to a year. Heather gasped and tried to hide it. This couldn't be right. Claude was looking so much better. And the treatment will make me ill. So she had been listening.
Audiobook of the week.
All right, that's your pick for this week, and that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Ellie Griffiths for joining us. Check out her new book, The Last Word. A lot of fun. And that'll do it for us. Tell a friend. Share it on Facebook. Share it on all your socials. My name is Dave Medicus. See ya.
Adios.
Excelsior. Don't ask questions. Don't apologize.